Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and happy holidays. Thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Before we get started today, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors, the folks over at Markham Search. Markham Search offers premier recruiting services throughout the United States with offices in Los Angeles, New York, and Boston. So a special thank you to our sponsors today, and a special thank you to Dean Bill Maurer. Dean Bill Maurer, PhD, is the Dean of the School of Social Sciences and a professor of anthropology, criminology, law, and society at the University of California, Irvine. An anthropologist, he is one of the world's leading experts on money artifacts and technological systems, from cowrie shells to credit cards. He is the author of numerous books and articles, including most recently, How Would You Like to Pay? How Technology is Changing the Future of Money, and recently edited, Paid, Tales of Dongles, Checks, and Other Money Stuff. The director of the Institute for Money, Technology, and Financial Inclusion, which was founded by the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation, Maurer coordinates research in over 40 countries on how new payment technologies impact poor people's well-being. The Institute was named a Center of Excellence for Financial Technology by the Feline Research Institute, which supports the credit union industry. He is also a founding member of the Future of Money Research Collaborative and is currently editing The Cultural History of Money in 6 volumes covering antiquity to present. He recently received a grant from the U.S. National Science Foundation for a new project on blockchain technology and the law, and is directing an interdisciplinary technology, law, and society research group, also with the NSF support. Maurer's work has had an impact on U.S. and global policies for mobile payment and financial access, and has been covered in venues ranging from Bloomberg's Business Week to the New York Times, Forbes, and Marketplace. He was appointed to the Board of Behavioral, Cognitive, and Sensory Sciences of the National Academy of Science in 2015, and also advised the Department of Treasury and Federal Reserve on the redesign of U.S. paper currency. Additionally, he has advised the British Museum and Smithsonian on money-related artifacts and exhibitions. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the Feline Research Institute. He received his bachelor's degree in anthropology from Vassar College and his master's and doctoral degrees in anthropology from Stanford University. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Bill. It's so great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jennifer. I appreciate being here. And I bet you're going to ask me, how on earth did I get that job that you just
described? Yes, please. I love talking to people about their passions and how we all have this opportunity to follow our dreams. How did you achieve so much and at such a young age, nonetheless?
Well, first of all, I am no longer that young, but thank you.
And you still are.
Second of all, I think, you know, the real lesson for me has to do with serendipity and being open to discovery. As you said, I'm an anthropologist by training. And if we focus first on the professor part of my job and the anthropology side, the research side and the teaching that I do there, you know, that was kind of almost an accident. It was just happenstance. When I went to college, like a lot of people, I kind of imagined that I would become a medical doctor. And so I was a bio major, and I took a ton of courses in chemistry and biology, and I really enjoyed it. I was very good in science in high school, and I enjoyed what I was doing as an undergraduate in college. I didn't even know what anthropology was. I didn't really have a sense that, you know, it existed as a field that one could pursue and get a job in. But there was one term in the sophomore year of college when I had room for an elective on top of all the bio and math and chemistry and stuff. And no joke, I went to the bookstore. This is back in the day when you had to go and buy books and like physical books, and you had to go to the actual bookstore. And you know, I just went to the beginning shelves and the books were alphabetized by field, right? They were alphabetized by the courses that were offered. So anthropology was first. And I started there. And it was something like 2.5 or 3 hours later, I realized that I had just lost myself in the books in the anthropology section. I was sitting on the floor, like picking these things off the shelves and reading them. And I was completely captivated. I was like, oh my gosh, there's a whole field where people devote their lives to studying other people's cultures and other people's life ways. So I was hooked, but I was also cautious. What I did is I dropped one class. I forget what it was. It was one like elective type chemistry class. I dropped one, but I kept environmental chemistry. I kept organic chemistry and I kept environmental biology. And I added 2 anthropology classes. And that just sold me. I was completely hooked. And, you know, I'll tell you another quick story. One of the classes that blew my mind was called Peoples and Cultures of the Soviet Union. And that dates me a little bit. So this is when there was still a Soviet Union. And one of the things that the professor did is he had us read Konstantin Stanislavsky's book, An Actor Prepares. And this is a handbook for method acting, right? And I remember thinking, you know, why on earth are we reading this method acting book in an anthropology class? But what the professor was trying to do for us is show us that by teaching more convincingly Russian, he was trying to get them to be explicit. He was trying to get them to be explicit about their own culture and to convincingly portray that on the stage. And that just blew my mind. And basically, like I said, I was hooked. I had the awkward phone call with my parents, right? Like, I don't know if I'm going to be a doctor. I think I want to be an anthropologist. And, you know, they were super supportive. They were a little bit concerned about, you know, my future employability. but they were supportive and they allowed me to follow my passion. And, you know, they allowed me to kind of take this path that opened before me because I had allowed myself to discover and to discover something new and to follow my nose.
Wow. I mean, it's so great too that your parents supported you in that, because I feel like so many of us, we live in our parents' shadows. Our parents want us to grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer. And so for your parents to lovingly accept that and embrace that is very big of them.
Yeah, you know, they're retired now. They were both teachers. My mom was an elementary school teacher. My dad was a music teacher. And I think that they figured, well, you know, if all else fails, he'll be a teacher and that's a noble profession and he'll be following in our footsteps. So I guess they figured that that would be the kind of insurance policy. They were freaked out. I mean, I don't want to minimize that. They were like, you want to do what and how exactly is that going to pay the bills? But again, they understood that, that this was something that was a passion that I had discovered on my own, and they supported.
So tell me a little bit about this idea of going from, okay, I'm going to study anthropology, to becoming one of the foremost experts in the world on currency and the dean of a major university. At what point did you begin to play around with the idea of A, specializing in currency, and B, this idea of becoming the dean of a major university? Those are no small feats in and of themselves.
Yeah, no, those are excellent questions. And we'll start with the money part, with the currency part. And you know, there again, it was kind of serendipity. When I was an undergraduate and I had become an anthropology major, I had the opportunity to go abroad and to do my own independent research abroad. And I did that on the island of Dominica, which is in the Caribbean, not the Dominican Republic, but Dominica. It's a different island.
Okay.
I was interested in agricultural development. I was interested in sort of rural economies in the Caribbean and what Caribbean countries that weren't tourist sites were doing to ensure their economic viability. Very much kind of a, you know, economics and development kind of project, but with an anthropology orientation. And it taught me a great deal. I learned a lot. And then in graduate school, when I was trying to decide what to do for my dissertation work, I thought, you know, maybe I'll go back to Dominica and see, you know, what's happened and write something about kind of culture change and technology and that sort of a thing. Well, I looked up some of my old buddies from Dominica, and almost all of them had left. they had mostly gone to the British Virgin Islands, also in the Caribbean. And I thought, huh, well, that all by itself is interesting. Like, maybe what I'll do is study migration within the Caribbean and how that is affecting the societies and cultures of the region. So I went to the British Virgin Islands and, was working on migration. And kind of at a corner of my eye, pretty much every single day, I would walk past all of these accountancy firms and banks and trust companies. And, because I was focused on migration, I wasn't really paying attention to that. And I didn't really have any understanding of what was going on. But what was going on, of course, was the British Virgin Islands had become a global financial services center and had become a tax haven, basically a place where people incorporate in order to avoid the regulatory regimes and the revenue collectors of their home country. And my dissertation advisor was like, that's actually really interesting. And maybe you should pay attention to that. Like, that's part of the story here of migration. All of your friends left Dominica to go to the BVI because of all the jobs that were created in construction and in, accounting services and that sort of thing by the tax haven economy. So that's what I did. I basically kind of pivoted and started trying to understand how a tiny little place like the British Virgin Islands can become a global financial services center. And that kind of sparked the interest in money. And as I did more research and did more writing, I was invited at one point to write a review essay on the anthropology of money and finance, how anthropologists as opposed to economists treat money and finance. So I wrote this essay, and usually when you write things like this, they're for the field, they're for graduate students, they're for the handful of people in your subspecialty who are going to care about it. But an amazing thing actually happened, which is one day I was sitting in my office and there's a knock on the door. I open the door and there's this sort of dorky guy, not kidding, with a pocket protector and pens in his pocket in a button-down short sleeve shirt, the type of shirt and khaki pants. And he's holding a copy of my article. And he says, "Did you write this piece?" And I'm a little nervous, right? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, "I would love to talk to you about it. My name is Scott, and I'm from the Intel Corporation. And we're starting to think about money. And we're starting to think about money and technology." And Scott became a great friend and a close research collaborator. And he really introduced me to that whole domain of money and new technologies. And again, like, I kind of just followed my instincts, and Scott and his colleagues opened all kinds of doors for me to get into the world of the payments industry and the interface between technology and money. And that's sort of where I've gone ever since. And I think because I'm an anthropologist, I was more interested than most people would have been in things like the artifacts associated with digital payments. And we don't normally think about these things as artifacts, but we use them every single day. Credit cards, with a mag stripe on them or a chip and pin, the card readers themselves, and how they operate, all the other kind of material infrastructures that make digital payments possible. And that's ultimately why the British Museum and the Smithsonian, were interested in what I was doing and why I was able to collaborate with them too. So, I think that it's been good to have this unique anthropological perspective on these questions, both because it helps me help other people think about the human side of money and its technologies, and also because it helps me help others tell that story, tell the history of money and all of the sort of material and digital things associated with it. But I haven't spoken about the deanship yet. Would you like me to do that next?
Yeah, please. Absolutely. And I think I just want a side note here. What's really fascinating that I love, Bill, is that you had a passion and you followed it, kind of bewildered by you're just kind of following the yellow brick road, so to speak, of your career. And you kind of went one direction and then you followed it to the next direction, which led you to being one of the foremost experts in the world in your field. And I think that's just something worth mentioning of how important it is to listen to our intuition and just to kind of follow the guideposts. When Scott or your proverbial Scott shows up in your office, embrace it and say, okay, well, I might not be the expert I think I need to be to have this interview with got, but I'm still going to give it my best.
You know, that's an excellent point. I've seen friends of mine and colleagues sometimes get tripped up by fear when they have these moments where, you know, where their Scott will show up and they'll be like, no, I don't really have anything to offer. I'm just going to go away or close the door, right? Or alternately, they'll be sort of snooty about it, right? Like, I don't want to, you know, sully myself with, you know, this company or this connection. I want to stand above it all and blah, blah, blah. Whereas I've always been like, that's interesting. This guy thinks my work is interesting. And that's really nice and kind of flattering. And maybe I'll spend some time with him and see where it goes. But, you know, with the deanship, it's an interesting thing. I never set out to be dean. I mean, I never set out to be an anthropologist either. But I think I really never set out to be dean. I was perfectly content as a professor who was teaching and doing research and that sort of a thing. But I had some wonderful mentors in the School of Social Sciences at UC Irvine, including the former dean, Barbara Doscher. And she had always really encouraged me to think about leadership positions in the university. And she actually made a couple of opportunities available to me. She kind of brought me into the fold and appointed me as her associate dean for research and graduate studies, which, you know, it did a bunch of things. I mean, I was just about to say, kind of jokingly, it taught me about budget, but that's really a serious thing. You know, it taught me like, Excel is not just for research purposes. People actually use Excel to do other things like plan budgets that matter and that make institutions run. And I know that probably sounds silly to a lot of your listeners, but to a faculty member at a research university, for the most part, you know, Excel is just for your research, not for actually kind of planning a business, so to speak. So that was an important lesson. And it also got me thinking about the institution and the work that it takes to make an institution run and the things that I could offer to that. So when the deanship became available, a number of my colleagues encouraged me to put my name in the running for it, which I did. And, you know, at first I thought, well, this will mainly be an opportunity for me essentially to educate the search committee, to educate the campus about the contributions of our school and about, you know, what's important about the social sciences and why the rest of the university should care about it. I really did not think that I would be chosen. You know, there was a national level search and there were tons of other candidates. And again, I felt that my job was basically to educate the campus, to help them understand, you know, what we did and why we were important. So when the call came from the provost offering me the job, I actually made her repeat it. I was like, wait, what? Come again? What? Really? Me? And then I was like, oh, no, I have to now think about what this is really going to mean. But, you know, another important thing here is that when we have these opportunities, we're never on our own, right? I think a lot of people think, you know, I'll get that big job and then I will lead the institution. But that's not my attitude at all. My attitude has always been like, oh, I got the job. It's a good thing there's a lot of other people around to help me lead this institution who know what they're doing and can help me understand the systems and processes when I fall short. And, you know, I think I've been just really fortunate to be at a place where there's an awful lot of goodwill and a lot of collaboration and people willing to help out. And, you know, another thing I'll say about the deanship, because I really didn't understand this going into it, every single day is different. And every single day I'm bopping around between any number of extremely different kinds of things, from, you know, from a complicated discussion around space planning and budget to conversations about curricular design and reform, to conversations about new ways of you know, providing instruction to our very diverse student body, the conversations about ensuring that UC Irvine continues to provide access to all the students that we serve. And as you know, the New York Times has ranked UC Irvine the number one in the country in terms of advancing the American dream by providing access to low-income students and students from diverse backgrounds. And even, you know, every day there's some little crisis or some fire that needs to be put out. And even those crises are instructive. And they always remind me again that there's a lot of competent people around me who can help me and who can help us do what we need to do to make the university run. So I actually quite enjoy it. You know, I'm surprised by how much I've enjoyed the work. It's a whole different level of commitment from what it was as a normal professor. But again, it's unbelievably rewarding. And, you know, when I can do something that results in the construction of new infrastructure, like we've recently built a neuroimaging lab with a brand new fMRI machine. And I know that that's going to advance research and learning on the brain beyond my tenure as dean. Or when we set up a new major, we have a new major in international studies. I know that I'm impacting not just students right now, but people who were training now who were going to go on to, you know, do incredible things throughout their entire careers. And then that really makes all the difference and kind of propels me forward.
I think it's such a brilliant point, Bill, that you brought up about knowing that there's people around you who are there to support you. In those instances where you're given that opportunity, I think our fears really control us and they cause us pain and suffering. And so many times we might look back at our life and pass up that opportunity to have that interview with the Scott or to take that leap of faith and take that job that you ask yourself in that moment, am I really qualified to do this? But if you're willing to just realize the resources that you have around you, I think there was a great quote. One of my favorite books was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill from many years ago. And I believe it was about Henry Ford who said, listen, I'm not the smartest man out there, but this guy is and that guy is and this person can help me. And it's about just knowing that you have resources even in the moment. I remember I was offered a chance earlier this year to write my first white paper, and I had never in my life written anything scientific probably since I went to UC Irvine, and thank God I had people much smarter than me. And, you know, you teach yourself, but you say yes. I think half the battle is whether it's a job or an interview, showing up and being willing to go on that interview, even if it's uncomfortable, or being willing to take a job that's a stretch job for you or something outside of your comfort zone is what life is all about and how people reach for the stars and how we live our lives without regrets.
Yep. You know, someone actually once said to me that one of the most powerful things that you can ask when you're in a position like mine is, what do you think? Because in turning to someone else, you know, you're empowering them and you're also communicating with them. I actually care what you think. I don't have all the answers. You may have a perspective that I'm missing. You may have knowledge that I don't have. You may know things, you know, at the ground level that I can't see from my position as dean. And I always try to remember that and to make sure that I'm asking people, so, you know, what do you think? What about you? And that's, you know, another thing about that too, is it really means that you've got to ensure that you've got like the most diverse group of people around you all the time. So you don't just have a bunch of, you know, yes people around you, or you don't just have a bunch of people who are going to passively say, well, you know, he's the guy in charge, I'm just going to do what he says. But you have people who will press back against you. You have people who, you know, come from other walks of life, come from diverse backgrounds, who are different from you and who can kind of help you see around corners and, you know, use their perspective to inform what you're going to do in your job so that you can do the best job that you can.
Yeah, I love the direction that hiring is going. I think I had a chief diversity officer on the show in the last year, and the chief diversity officer and I were talking about how we inadvertently wind up hiring people like ourselves, talk about from a bias perspective. We don't even mean to, but if everybody is the same shape, color, size, taste, flavor, then you have no diversity. And I think there was a great example of that with NASA when they were trying to get man to the moon, and they had very similar types of people working on it day and night for months and months. And finally, one day they said, you know what, we're not getting anywhere. Why can't we get man to the moon? And finally, somebody came in and said, let's bring in people outside of this genre, this group of engineers, people who might just think differently. And within less than a month, they were able to get man to the moon. And it's all about just bringing in those different perspectives. I remember last year, we did a team escape room thing with my team internally. And it was so extraordinary to see how everybody in the room solved a different sort of puzzle. And I feel like the escape room is analogous to us in the workplace or us at home, is every person brings a different element of their personality that can help the betterment of the whole. Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. I think that's a great analogy too, with the escape room, because that's kind of what it's like every single day. We always have these puzzles and challenges and we're like, all right, how do we do this?
Yeah, exactly. I'll go behind the painting. You go under the table.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of how do we utilize our diverse talents and backgrounds to collaboratively like solve the puzzle, right? And that's kind of what it's like every day. But you really have to be open to that, right? A lot of people aren't open to it, either because they're afraid. And it's interesting, like, what they're afraid of. Sometimes I think people are afraid because, again, they want to seem like they're, you know, the person in charge, and they say, ask questions, or if they need to lean on others' expertise, then they're seen as weak or something. Other times I think that they're afraid because they really just don't know what to do, and then don't know what to do with that knowledge if they don't know what to do. And for me, like, you know, if I don't know what to do, that's actually kind of exciting, because then I get to learn something, and I get to learn something new about how things work. And, you know, I might not always like it. It might not work the way that I want it to work, but at least I'll be better informed in the future when I face, you know, new challenges or problems.
Yeah, and I think it's about having that openness of mind, because I think you're right. When you start off in the workplace, there's this rigidity of thinking, where in college, and again, I gratefully went to UC Irvine and graduated when I was very young. And I remember I learned, and I was very good at reading books and retaining information and taking tests. And then it's kind of like the mother duck, or the mother duck sends a little duckling out into the world. And you're like, okay, well, I know how to waddle and how to flap my wings, but I have no idea what it looks like to actually be a duck in the world. And so you're out there just kind of bumping into things and people, and you just try to be so rigid. You try to do things exactly the way you saw them. And what you don't realize is that there's a fluidity to it. And the more that you embrace the fluidity and you embrace the curiosity, and that you're never going to know anything. I think Socrates was the one who originally said, I can't remember the quote right now, but about that I know nothing at all is what the wisest man says. Because if we go out into the world after we get a degree, whether it's a bachelor's, a master's, a PhD, yes, you reach a certain level of knowledge, a tipping point, but then there's the other side of it, is the things that you don't know are always going to continually grow by the same leaps and bounds of the things you already know.
Yep. No, very well said. I think that's a crucial point.
Yeah. So tell me, you know, say we have some listeners out there, and, you know, there are I have a lot of professors and friends in my circle, and it's such a admirable profession for anybody out there who's a teacher, be it any level of teaching up to professor. What if somebody out there is thinking, gosh, you know, this Dean Bill Maurer guy is really inspiring me, and I think I might have it in me to do what this guy did. What does that look like? How do you actually get to the point where you could consider to be a dean applicant at a major university?
Mm. So I think, you know, to start with the professor part first, I mean, the professor part is a huge commitment, right? Both in terms of graduate school and establishing a research profile that's going to get you a job teaching at a college or a university. And I don't want anyone to have any illusions about that. Around 50% of the people who earn PhDs these days go on to careers outside of academia. And so I think that if you get on that train, you have to be, you know, clear-eyed about the fact that your future may not have an academic position in it, and that's okay. There are all kinds of alternative career tracks for people with PhDs, and industry and nonprofits and governments are always looking for folks with the kind of skills that people with PhDs have. But then on the dean part, you know, I know what I would say, but I don't know if anyone else, I don't know who else would say this. Like, I think it's really important, if you're thinking about a job in academic administration, to have some humility about it and to realize that, again, like, part of the job is being responsive and open to the diverse constituencies that you serve, and to remember that you serve them. they don't serve you, right? It's not about your own self-aggrandizement. It's about what you can do in this kind of position to make the institution better and to make it better to serve ultimately the students and the scientific community that make it a vibrant part of our, you know, of our society. You know, in terms of what you can do to prepare for that, I would say take advantage of every opportunity that you get to do something other than your own research and teaching. I think professors often think, you know, the only way that I'm going to advance is through my own research and maybe through my own teaching. But then when opportunities come up to do something on the administrative side, they won't go for it. Or if they're given an opportunity to, you know, to speak in public about their work, they'll shy away from it because they'd rather be in the classroom where, you know, where they're in control and where the students sort of obediently listen and ask the right questions than in like a public forum where you never know what's going to happen and what sort of person is going to show up and ask them crazy questions. And also, you know, when other folks in the university give you those opportunities to do something outside your comfort zone, I would say take it, you know, just always take it because you're going to learn something. And I know this also is going to sound sort of silly, but when you take those opportunities, like be mindful of them, like, you know, pay attention, don't just sort of do it in a slapdash kind of way, and then document it. You know, too often we do things and maybe we think, oh, well, that was bad. I did a bad job at that. Let's just forget about it. But, you know, what we should do is we should write it down. We should say, yeah, you know, I did this thing. Maybe it didn't go as well as I wanted it to go. Here are some of the problems that I had. Be reflective about it, right? Write about it and document it, because then you can say later on, you know, look, here are all of the experiences I had that make me a compelling candidate for this position. And also here are some of the instances where I failed or where I think that I didn't actually do the best job I could have done. And here's what I might do differently next time. Because I think it's really important for people to be able to express those failures and think about how they grew from them and then use them for their next position. Instead of just sort of pretending it never happened or running away from it or trying to hide it. I think but those are really my key things.
Yeah, I think that's such great advice, because I remember years and years ago, one of the first personal development classes I did, they gave the example of Michael Jordan and how after every basketball game, he would pour while some of his other teammates might just go off and have fun or shower or just get, you know, relaxed after the game. He would pour over video footage, watching himself from every shot, every angle. How could he have made that three-pointer that he missed? On the three-pointer that he got, did the, you know, what was the positioning of his feet? You know, what was he breathing deeply at that moment? And I think that whether we're talking about becoming the dean of a major university, a major, you know, athletic champion, or a champion in whatever field is most important to you, it's that level of discipline multiplied by desire. So it's having that desire, that yearning for that thing, and then following it up with the discipline and the dedication. It's that silly meme that everybody always sees on social media about the iceberg. And when people see somebody, whether you're the dean of a school, a political leader, the CEO of an organization, people only see the tip of the iceberg and they think, oh, perhaps Jennifer Hill had it easier. Dean Maurer was, you know, given this job or had a silver spoon. People unwittingly assume that there's no work that goes into it and that people just fall into it. They don't realize that you have to chase, you know, migration around different islands in the Caribbean while you're fine-tuning in the back of your mind, you know, what do I really want to study? And then be willing to let go of what you're originally studying. It's, you know, it's so funny, Bill, because sometimes I think it's raccoons. If they get something shiny in their hand, they'll hold it in their hand, even if their hand gets caught in a box, until they die because of the fact that they won't let it go. And sometimes you might think that your path is to be a dean or to study migration patterns or to do something else. But until you're willing to let go of that thing that no longer serves you, you won't be able to move into your true path.
Mm-hmm. No, again, that's an excellent point. I think that people hold on to these things that they think are their dream, but often it was somebody else's dream,
right.
You know, or, you know, it was like their parents' dream or society's dream or, you know, one of their mentors' dreams, but not their own. And we need to be able to let yourself find that dream, which sometimes involves a little bit of wandering around. And then again, when you think you're on that path, I think it involves really kind of learning your lessons along the way from the successes as well as the failures.
Yeah, and just taking that time, even if it's not spending hours and hours, whether you go in for a normal job interview or you give your first talk, just take 5 minutes and reflect and ask yourself, was there anything missing that could have made a difference in that interview? Was there anything missing that could have made a difference in that talk? And the more that we allow ourselves to become self-aware, the more we have the capacity for growth and change and to achieve dreams that sometimes we didn't even know we had.
Yeah. I think often too, people second guess things, right? And they think, well, I've got to win the right strategy for this meeting and play various games. And often all that they're really doing is playing a game with themselves, and they just need to stop and think and say, all right, what am I bringing to the table? What are my concerns? What are my issues? But also what are the strengths and skills I build and the knowledge that I'm bringing that the other people in the room are not going to have? And if I stand on that knowledge and those contributions confidently, then, other people are going to see that and we're going to learn from that. And even if things don't go the way that I thought I wanted them to go at the beginning, at least I'm going to be in a better position for the next conversation, for the next meeting, for the next challenge. And I think that, folks in general really appreciate that kind of openness about one's own strengths, but also one's own limitations.
Yeah. Bill, I could talk to you for hours, my friend, but I do want to know, were there any other questions I didn't ask you or any points that you would love to just make sure people take away from today's show, little tidbits?
I think that I would, again, just say that that serendipity is incredibly powerful, but that that people always need to be open to it. And too often we sort of just have blinders on and close ourselves off to things that we don't think are on the path that we imagine for ourselves that we've been planning out since sixth grade or whatever. And, it's okay to let go of those things. And, they might be illusions, they might not be illusions, but just like your raccoon story, you can let go just a little bit and then see where that takes you. I guess I'll end on this. Too often we think that if we're on one pole of something, that the only alternative is to be on the complete opposite side. but it's not like that. Like, you can move just a little bit. You don't have to move all the way. you can move a little bit in a different direction and try it out before running back home to your comfort zone. And you might find that, you were actually more comfortable a little bit further on and a little bit further away from what you thought was your comfort zone in the beginning.
I love that. That's such a great point and a great takeaway, because what better time than the holidays? Right now, we have this opportunity to get outside of our comfort zones. We have new opportunities, new experiences. The new year is right around the corner, and it's a perfect opportunity just to tiptoe out. You can just stick your toe out. Just maybe put your toe out on that pole that Bill's talking about. And just maybe rebalance, recalibrate yourself. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and they said it's kind of like Waze, where it says rerouting, recalculating. And sometimes, you think you're going to go left and you wind up going right, and then Waze starts telling you recalculating, and it might actually be a better route that Waze just wasn't aware of, or you might have saved yourself some hardship down that other path.
Yep, absolutely.
So, Bill, tell our listeners, if people want to look up some of the work that you're doing on all of these amazing currencies, or if they want to find out more information, perhaps they might have somebody in their life who's looking into universities, what would you tell them if they want to learn about you or Cerebine?
Well, if people want to learn about me and my work, the best place to go is to the website for the institute that I direct, and that's the Institute for Money, Technology, and Financial Inclusion, and it's just www.imtfi.uci.edu. It's really easy to find via Google, and there you'll see all my various projects and things and the collaborations that I have with other people. And if folks are interested in the School of Social Sciences and UC Irvine, I would just go to the UCI website and also go to the Social Sciences website. It's just socsci.uci.edu. We've got a number of fun videos about the school and featured news and upcoming events. almost all of which are open to the public. So, you know, if you're local, you know, you're always welcome to come to campus and attend a lecture or a seminar or a workshop or some other event on the campus. In terms of the, you know, if people out there are faculty members thinking about academic administration, you know, really the best source to start reading regularly is the Chronicle of Higher Education, and just get a sense of the state of higher education in America, the administration of higher education, and some of the issues that colleges and universities are facing. There's also an association called the American Association of University Administrators, the AAUA, and it also has some interesting resources on its website for those who are thinking about that kind of career move.
Brilliant. I will be sure to put those down in the recap of the show so people can find that. And speaking of the recap of the show, if you missed any portion of today's show, do keep in mind it will be available almost immediately after the show on the latalkradio.com website under the Get Yourself the Job page at the bottom in the archive section. And we always have a nice little recap that will include things like what Bill just mentioned. And if you want to tune in later in the week, we invite you to listen, subscribe at your leisure on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. You can find all of our prior shows listed on there and find future shows on there as well. So wishing everybody a very happy early holiday. We invite you to tune in next week at 4 p.m. as we have one of the top speaking experts in the world, Allison Shapiro, joining us on the show, where she's going to give you tips and tricks in order to be effective at communicating your way to success, whatever that might look like, whether it's an upcoming interview you have or maybe an important presentation. So thank you as always for tuning in, and thank you so much, Bill, for joining us on the show today and sharing your wisdom with us.
Well, thank you. It's really, really been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Okay. Happy holidays, everyone.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.